Cycles. It is early in November of 1942, and a simply unbelievable amount of shit is going on, all at once, everywhere. Zeus himself would not be able to sort it all out, not even if he mobilized the Caryatids. Tell them never mind what we told you, just drop those loads. Temples collapsing everywhere like spyglasses. He'd send those Caryatids, and any naiads and dryads he could scare up, to library school, issue them green visors, dress them in the prim asexual uniforms of the OPAMs, the Olympian Perspective Archive Management Service, put them to work filling out 3x5 cards round the clock, get them to use some of that vaunted Caryatid steadfastness to tend holorith machines and ETC card readers. Even then, Zeus would probably still lack a handle on the situation. He'd be so pissed off he would hardly know which hubristical mortals to fling his thunderbolts at, nor which pin-up girls and buck privates to molest. Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse is as Olympian as anyone right now. Roosevelt and Churchill and the few others on the ultra-mega list have the same access, but they have other cares and distractions. They can't wander around the data flow capital of the planet, snooping over translators' shoulders and reading the decrypts as they come, chunkity-chunkity-whirr out of the Typex machines. They cannot trace individual threads of the global narrative at their whim, running from hut to hut, patching connections together, even as the Wrens in Hut 11 string patch cables from one bomb socket to another, fashioning a web to catch Hitler's messages as they speed through the ether. Here are some of the things Waterhouse knows. The Battle of El Alamein is won, and Montgomery is chasing Rommel westwards across Cyrenaica at what looks like a breakneck pace, driving him back toward the distant Axis stronghold of Tunis. But it's not the route it appears to be. If Monty would only grasp the significance of the intelligence coming through the Ultra Channel, he would be able to move decisively to surround and capture large pockets of Germans and Italians. But he never does, and so Rommel stages an orderly retreat, preparing to fight another day and plotting Monty as roundly cursed in the watchrooms of Bletchley Park for his failure to exploit their priceless but perishable gems of intelligence. The largest sea lift in history just piled into Northwest Africa. It's called Operation Torch, and it's going to take Rommel from behind, serving as anvil to Montgomery's hammer, or if Monty doesn't pick up the pace a bit, maybe the other way around. It looks brilliantly organized, but it's not really. This is the first time America has punched across the Atlantic in any serious way, and so a whole grab bag of stuff is included on those ships, including any number of signals intelligence geeks who are storming theatrically onto the beaches as if they were Marines. Also included in the landing is the American contingent of Detachment 2702, a hand-picked wrecking crew of combat-hardened leathernecks. Some of these Marines learned what they know on Guadalcanal, a basically useless island in the Southwest Pacific where the Empire of Nippon and the United States of America are disputing, with rifles, each other's right to build a military airbase. Early returns suggest that the Nipponese army, during its extended tour of East Asia, has lost its edge. It would appear that raping the entire female population of Nanjing and bayoneting helpless Filipino villagers does not translate into actual military competence. The Nipponese army is still trying to work out some way to kill, say, 100 American Marines without losing, say, 500 of its own soldiers. The Japanese Navy is a different story. They know what they are doing. They have Yamamoto. They have torpedoes that actually explode when they strike their targets, in stark contrast to the American models, which do nothing but scratch the paint of the Japanese ships and then sink apologetically. Yamamoto just made another attempt to wipe out the American fleet off the Santa Cruz Islands, sank Hornet, and blew a nice hole in Enterprise. But he lost a third of his planes. Watching the Japanese rack up losses, Waterhouse wonders if anyone in Tokyo has bothered to break out the abacus and run the numbers on this Second World War thing. The Allies are doing some math of their own, and they are scared shitless. There are 100 German U-boats in the Atlantic now, operating mostly from Lorient and Bordeaux, and they are slaughtering convoys in the North Atlantic with such efficiency that it's not even combat, just a Lusitanian-level murder spree. They are on a pace to sink something like 1 million tons of shipping this month, which Waterhouse cannot really comprehend. He tries to think of a ton as being roughly equivalent to a car, and then tries to imagine America and Canada going out into the middle of the Atlantic and simply dropping a million cars into the ocean. Just in November. Sheesh. The problem is shark. The Germans call it Triton. It is a new cipher system used exclusively by their navy. It is an Enigma machine, but not the usual three-wheel Enigma. The Poles learned how to break that old thing a couple of years ago, and Bletchley Park industrialized the process. But more than a year ago, a German U-boat was beached intact on the south coast of Iceland and gone over pretty thoroughly by men from Bletchley. They discovered an Enigma box with niches for four, not three, wheels. When the four-wheel Enigma had gone into service on February 1st, the entire Atlantic had gone black. Alan and the others have been going after the problem very hard ever since. The problem is that they don't know how the fourth wheel is wired up. But a few days ago, another U-boat was captured, more or less intact, in the eastern Mediterranean. Colonel Chatton, who happened to be in the neighborhood, went there with sickening haste, along with some other Bletchleyites. They recovered a four-wheel Enigma machine, and though this doesn't break the code, it gives them the data they need to break it. Hitler must be feeling cocky anyway, because he's on tour at the moment, preparatory to a working vacation at his Alpine retreat. That didn't prevent him from taking over what was left of France. Apparently something about Operation Torch really got his goat, so he occupied Vichy France in its entirety, and then dispatched upwards of 100,000 fresh troops and a correspondingly stupendous amount of supplies across the Mediterranean to Tunisia. Waterhouse imagines that you must be able to cross from Sicily to Tunisia these days simply by hopping from the deck of one German transport ship to another. Of course, if that were true, Waterhouse's job would be a lot easier. The Allies could sink as many of those ships as they wanted to without raising a single blonde Teutonic eyebrow on the information theory front. But the fact is that the convoys are few and far between. Just exactly how few and how far between are parameters that go into the equations that he and Alan Matheson Turing spend all night scribbling on chalkboards. After a good 8 or 12 hours of that, when the sun has finally come up again, there's nothing like a brisk bicycle ride in the Buckinghamshire countryside. Spread out before them as they pump over the crest of the rise is a woods that has turned all of the colors of flame. The hemispherical crowns of the maples even contribute a realistic billowing effect. Lawrence feels a funny compulsion to take his hands off the handlebars and clamp them over his ears. As they coast into the trees, however, the air remains delightfully cool, the blue sky above unsmudged by pillars of black smoke, and the calm and quiet of the place could not be more different from what Lawrence is remembering.
"Talk, talk, talk,"
says Alan Turing, imitating the squawk of furious hens. The strange noise is made stranger by the fact that he is wearing a gas mask, until he becomes impatient and pulls it up onto his forehead. "How they love to hear themselves talk!" He is referring to Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt. "And they don't mind hearing each other talk, up to a point at least. But voice is a terribly redundant channel of information compared to printed text. If you take text and run it through an Enigma, which is really not all that complicated, the familiar patterns in the text, such as the preponderance of the letter E, become nearly undetectable." Then he pulls the gas mask back over his face in order to emphasize the following point.
"But you can warp and permeate voice in the most fiendish ways imaginable, and it will still be perfectly intelligible to a listener."
Alan then suffers a sneezing fit that threatens to burst the khaki straps around his head. "Our ears know how to find the familiar patterns," Lawrence suggests. He is not wearing a gas mask because A, there is no Nazi gas mask in progress, and B, unlike Alan, he does not suffer from hay fever.
"Excuse me."
Alan suddenly breaks and jumps off his bicycle. He lifts the rear wheel from the pavement, gives it a spin with his free hand, then reaches down and gives the chain a momentary sideways tug. He is watching the mechanism intently, interrupted by a few after-sneezes. The chain of Turing's bicycle has one weak link. The rear wheel has one bent spoke. When the link and the spoke come into contact with each other, the chain will part and fall onto the road. This does not happen at every revolution of the wheel, otherwise the bicycle would be completely useless. It only happens when the chain and the wheel are in a certain position with respect to each other. Based upon reasonable assumptions about the velocity that can be maintained by Dr. Turing, an energetic bicyclist, let us say 25 kilometers an hour, and the radius of his bicycle's rear wheel, a third of a meter, if the chain's weak link hit the bent spoke on every revolution, the chain would fall off every one-third of a second. In fact, the chain doesn't fall off unless the bent spoke and the weak link happen to coincide. Now, suppose that you describe the position of the rear wheel by the traditional Greek letter theta. Just for the sake of simplicity, say that when the wheel starts in the position where the bent spoke is capable of hitting the weak link, albeit only if the weak link happens to be there to be hit, then theta equals zero. If you're using degrees as your unit, then during a single revolution of the wheel, theta will climb all the way up to 359 degrees before cycling back around to zero. At which point, the bent spoke will be back in position to knock the chain off. And now suppose that you describe the position of the chain with the variable C in the following very simple way. You assign a number to each link on the chain. The weak link is numbered 0, the next is 1, and so on, up to L minus 1, where L is the total number of links in the chain. And again, for simplicity's sake, say that when the chain is in the position where its weak link is capable of being hit by the bent spoke, albeit only if the bent spoke happens to be there to hit it, then C equals zero. For purposes of figuring out when the chain is going to fall off of Dr. Turing's bicycle, then everything we need to know about the bicycle is contained in the values of theta and of C. That pair of numbers defines the bicycle's state. The bicycle has as many possible states as there can be different values of theta, C, but only one of those states, namely 0, 0, is the one that will cause the chain to fall off onto the road. Suppose we start off in that state. That is, with theta equals zero, C equals zero. But that the chain has not fallen off because Dr. Turing, knowing full well his bicycle state at any given time, has paused in the middle of the road, nearly precipitating a collision with his friend and colleague Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse because his gas mask blocks his peripheral vision. Dr. Turing is tugged sideways on the chain while moving it forward slightly, preventing it from being hit by the bent spoke. Now he gets on the bicycle again and begins to pedal forward. The circumference of his rear wheel is about 2 meters, and so when he has moved a distance of 2 meters down the road, the wheel has performed a complete revolution and reached the position theta equals zero again. That being the position, remember, when its bent spoke is in position to hit the weak link. What of the chain? Its position, defined by C, begins at zero and reaches one when its next link moves forward to the fatal position, then two, and so on. The chain must move in sync with the teeth on the sprocket at the center of the rear wheel, and that sprocket has N teeth. And so, after a complete revolution of the rear wheel, when theta equals zero again, C equals N. After a second complete revolution of the rear wheel, once again, theta equals zero, but now C equals 2N. The next time, it's C equals 3N, and so on. But remember that the chain is not an infinite linear thing, but a loop, having only L positions. At C equals L, it loops back around to C equals zero, and repeats the cycle. So when calculating the value of C, it is necessary to do modular arithmetic. That is, if the chain has 100 links, L equals 100, and the total number of links that have moved by is 135, then the value of C is not 135, but 35. Whenever you get a number greater than or equal to L, you just repeatedly subtract L until you get a number less than L. This operation is written by mathematicians as mod L. So the successive values of C, each time the rear wheel spins around to theta equals zero, are N mod L, 2N mod L, 3N mod L, and so on, more or less, depending on how close to infinitely long Turing wants to keep riding his bicycle. After a while, it seems infinitely long to Waterhouse. Turing's chain will fall off when his bicycle reaches the state theta equals zero, c equals zero. And this will happen when I, which is just a counter telling how many times the rear wheel has revolved, reaches some hypothetical value, such that in mod L equals zero, or, to put it in plain language, it will happen if there is some multiple of n, such as, 2n, 3n, 395n, or 109,948,368,443n, that just happens to be an exact number of L, too. Actually, there might be several of these so-called common multiples, but from a practical standpoint, the only one that matters is the first one, the least common multiple, or LCM, because that's the one that will be reached first, and that will cause the chain to fall off. If, say, the sprocket has 20 teeth, N equals 20, and the chain has 100 teeth, L equals 100, then after one turn of the wheel, we'll have C equals 20. After two turns, C equals 40, then 60, then 80, then 100. But since we are doing the arithmetic modulo 100, that value has to be changed to zero. So after five revolutions of the rear wheel, we have reached the state theta equals zero, C equals zero, and Turing's chain falls off. Five revolutions of the rear wheel only gets him 10 meters down the road, and so with these values of L and N, the bicycle is very nearly worthless. Of course, this is only true if Turing is stupid enough to begin pedaling with his bicycle in the chain-falling-off state. If, at the time he begins pedaling, it is in the state theta equals zero, C equals one instead, then the successive values will be C equals 21, 41, 61, 81, 1, 21, and so on forever. The chain will never fall off. But this is a degenerate case, where degenerate, to a mathematician, means annoyingly boring. In theory, as long as Turing put his bicycle into the right state before parking it outside a building, no one would be able to steal it. The chain would fall off after they had ridden for no more than 10 meters. But if Turing's chain has 101 links, L equals 101, then after five revolutions, we have C equals 100. And after 6, we have C equals 19. Then, C equals 39, 59, 79, 99, 18, 38, and so on. And not until the 101st revolution of the rear wheel does the bicycle return to the state theta equals 0, C equals 0, where the chain falls off. During these 101 revolutions, Turing's bicycle has proceeded for a distance of a fifth of a kilometer down the road, which is not too bad. So the bicycle is usable. However, unlike in the degenerate case, it is not possible for this bicycle to be placed in a state where the chain never falls off at all. This can be proved by going through the list of values of C and noticing that every possible value of C minus every single number from 0 to 100 is on the list. What this means is that no matter what values he has when Turing begins to pedal, sooner or later, it will work its way round to the fatal C equals zero, and the chain will fall off. So Turing can leave his bicycle anywhere and be confident that, if stolen, it won't go more than a fifth of a kilometer before the chain falls off. The difference between the degenerate and non-degenerate cases has to do with the properties of the numbers involved. The combination of N equals 20, L equals 100, has radically different properties from N equals 20, L equals 101. The key difference is that 20 and 101 are relatively prime, meaning that they have no factors in common. This means that their least common multiple, their LCM, is a large number. It is, in fact, equal to L times X equals 20 times 101 equals 2020. Whereas the LCM of 20 and 100 is only 100. The L equals 101 bicycle has a long period. It passes through many different states before returning back to the beginning, whereas the L equals 100 bicycle has a period of only a few states. Suppose that Turing's bicycle were a cipher machine that worked by alphabetic substitution, which is to say that it would replace each of the 26 letters of the alphabet with some other letter. An A in the plain text might become a T in the ciphertext. B might become F, C might become M, and so on all the way through to Z. In and of itself, this would be an absurdly easy cipher to break. Kids in treehouses stuff. But suppose that the substitution scheme changed from one letter to the next. That is, suppose that after the first letter of the plain text was enciphered using one particular substitution alphabet, the second letter of plain text was enciphered using a completely different substitution alphabet, and the third letter a different one yet, and so on. This is called a polyalphabetic cipher. Suppose that Turing's bicycle were capable of generating a different alphabet for each one of its different states. So the state theta equals zero, C equals zero would correspond to, say, a substitution alphabet in which A was transformed into Q, B into G, C into U, and so on. But the state theta equals 180, C equals 15 would correspond to a different substitution alphabet. No two letters would be enciphered using the same substitution alphabet until, that is, the bicycle worked its way back around to the initial state, theta equals zero, C equals zero, and began to repeat the cycle. This means that it is a periodic polyalphabetic system. Now, if this machine had a short period, it would repeat itself frequently and would therefore be useful as an encryption system only against kids in treehouses. The longer its period, the more relative primeness is built into it, the less frequently it cycles back to the same substitution alphabet and the more secure it is. The three-wheel enigma is just that type of system, that is, periodic polyalphabetic. Its wheels, like the drivetrain of Turing's bicycle, embody cycles within cycles. Its period is 17,576, which means that the substitution alphabet that enciphers the first letter of a message will not be used again until the 17,577th letter is reached. But with Shark, the Germans have added a fourth wheel, bumping the period up to 456,976. The wheels are set in a different randomly chosen starting position at the beginning of each message. Since the Germans' messages are never as long as 450,000 characters, the Enigma never reuses the same substitution alphabet in the course of a given message, which is why the Germans think it's so good. A flight of transport planes goes over them, probably headed for the aerodrome at Bedford. The planes make a weirdly musical diatonic hum, like bagpipes playing two drones at once. This reminds Lawrence of yet another phenomenon related to the bicycle wheel and the Enigma machine. "Do you know why airplanes sound the way they do?" he says.
"No, come to think of it."
Turing pulls his gas mask off again. His jaw has gone a bit slack, and his eyes are darting from side to side. Lawrence has caught him out.
"I noticed it at Pearl. Airplane engines are rotary," Lawrence says. "Consequently, they must have an odd number of cylinders."
"How does that follow?"
"If the number were even, the cylinders would be directly opposed, 180 degrees apart, and it wouldn't work out mechanically."
"Why not?"
"I forgot. It just wouldn't work out."
Alan raises his eyebrows, clearly not convinced.
"Something to do with cranks," Waterhouse ventures, feeling a little defensive.
"I don't know that I agree," Alan says.
"Well, just stipulate it. Think of it as a boundary condition," Waterhouse says.
But Alan is already hard at work, he suspects, mentally designing a rotary aircraft engine with an even number of cylinders.
"Anyway, if you look at them, they all have an odd number of cylinders," Lawrence continues. "So the exhaust noise combines with the propeller noise to produce that two-tone sound."
Alan climbs back onto his bicycle, and they ride into the woods for some distance without any more talking. Actually, they have not been talking so much as mentioning certain ideas and then leaving the other to work through the implications. This is a highly efficient way to communicate. It eliminates much of the redundancy that Alan was complaining about in the case of FDR and Churchill. Waterhouse is thinking about cycles within cycles. He's already made up his mind that human society is one of those cycles within cycles things. He has no hard data to back this up. It just seems like a cool idea. And now he's trying to figure out whether it is like Turing's bicycle,
works fine for a while, then suddenly the chain falls off, hence the occasional world war. Or like an Enigma machine, grinds away incomprehensibly for a long time, then suddenly the wheels line up like a slot machine and everything is made plain in some sort of global epiphany, or if you prefer, apocalypse. Or just like a rotary airplane engine. Runs and runs and runs. Nothing special happens, it just makes a lot of noise.
Somewhere around here,
Alan says, and violently breaks to a stop, just to chaff Lawrence, who has to turn his bicycle around, a chancy trick on such a narrow lane, and loop back. They lean their bicycles against trees and remove pieces of equipment from the baskets. Dry cells, electronic breadboards, poles, a trenching tool, loops of wire. Alan looks about somewhat uncertainly and then strikes off into the woods.
I'm off to America soon to work on this voice encryption problem at Bell Labs, Alan says.
Lawrence laughs ruefully.
We're ships passing in the night, you and I.
We are passengers on ships passing in the night, Alan corrects him. It is no accident. They need you precisely because I am leaving. I've been doing all of the 2701 work to this point.
It's Detachment 2702 now, Lawrence says.
Oh, Alan says, crestfallen. You noticed.
It was reckless of you, Alan.
On the contrary, Alan says. What will Rudy think if he notices that of all the units and divisions and detachments in the Allied order of battle, there is not a single one whose number happens to be the product of two primes?
Well, that depends upon how common such numbers are compared to all of the other numbers and on how many other numbers in the range are going unused,
Lawrence says, and begins to work out the first half of the problem.
Ah, Riemann's Zeta function again. That thing pops up everywhere.
That's the spirit, Alan says. Simply take a rational and common-sense approach. They are really quite pathetic.
Who? Here, Alan says, slowing to a stop and looking around at the trees, which to Lawrence look like all the other trees.
This looks familiar.
He sits down on the bowl of a windfall and begins to unpack electrical gear from his bag. Lawrence squats nearby and does the same. Lawrence does not know how the device works. It is Alan's invention, and so he acts in the role of surgical assistant, handing tools and supplies to the doctor as he puts the device together. The doctor is talking the entire time, and so he requests tools by staring at them fixedly and furrowing his brow.
They are. Well, who do you suppose? The fools who use all of the information that comes from Bletchley Park.
Alan?
Well, it is foolish. Like this Midway thing. That's a perfect example, isn't it?
Well, I was happy that we won the battle, Lawrence says guardedly.
Don't you think it's a bit odd, a bit striking, a bit noticeable, that after all of Yamamoto's brilliant feints and deceptions and ruses, this Nimitz fellow knew exactly where to go looking for him, out of the entire Pacific Ocean?
All right, Lawrence says. I was appalled. I wrote a paper about it. Probably the paper that got me into this mess with you.
Well, it's no better with us Brits, Alan says.
Really?
Oh, you would be horrified at what we've been up to in the Mediterranean. It's a scandal, a crime.
What have we been up to? Lawrence asks.
I say we rather than you, because we are allies now.
Yes, yes, Alan says impatiently.
So they claim.
He pauses for a moment, tracing an electrical circuit with his finger, calculating inductances in his head. Finally, he continues.
Well, we've been sinking convoys, that's what. German convoys. We've been sinking them right and left.
Rommels?
Yes, exactly. The Germans put fuel and tanks and ammunition on ships in Naples and send them south. We go out and sink them. We sink nearly all of them because we have broken the Italian C-38M cipher, and we know when they are leaving Naples. And lately, we've been sinking just the very ones that are most crucial to Rommel's efforts, because we have also broken his Chaffinch cipher, and we know which ones he is complaining loudest about not having.
Turing snaps a toggle switch on his invention, and a weird looping squeal comes from a dusty black paper cone lashed onto the breadboard with twine. The cone is a speaker, apparently scavenged from a radio. There is a broomstick with a loop of stiff wire dangling from the end, and a wire running from that loop up the stick to the breadboard.
He swings the broomstick around until the loop is dangling like a lasso in front of Lawrence's midsection. The speaker yelps.
Good, it's picking up your belt buckle,
Alan says. He sets the contraption down in the leaves, gropes in several pockets, and finally pulls out a scrap of paper on which several lines of text have been written in block letters. Lawrence would recognize it anywhere. It is a decrypt worksheet.
What's that, Alan?
I wrote out complete instructions and enciphered them, then hid them under a bridge in a benzedrine container, Alan says. Last week, I went and recovered the container and deciphered the instructions.
He waves the paper in the air.
What encryption scheme did you use?
One of my own devising. You are welcome to take a crack at it, if you like.
What made you decide it was time to dig this stuff up?
It was nothing more than a hedge against invasion, Alan says. Clearly, we're not going to be invaded now, not with you chaps in the war.
How much did you bury?
2 silver bars, Lawrence, each with a value of some 125 pounds. One of them should be very close to us.
Alan stands up, pulls a compass out of his pocket, turns to face magnetic north, and squares his shoulders. Then he rotates a few degrees.
Oh, can't remember whether I allowed for declination, he mumbles.
Right. In any case, 100 paces north.
And he strides off into the woods, followed by Lawrence, who has been given the job of carrying the metal detector. Just as Dr. Alan Turing can ride a bicycle and carry on a conversation while mentally counting the revolutions of the pedals, he can count paces and talk at the same time, too. Unless he has lost count entirely, which seems just as possible.
If what you are saying is true, Lawrence says, the jig must be up already. Reedy must have figured out that we've broken their codes.
An informal system has been in place, which might be thought of as a precursor to Detachment 2701 or 2702 or whatever we are calling it, Alan says. When we want to sink a convoy, we send out an observation plane first. It is ostensibly an observation plane. Of course, to observe is not its real duty. We already know exactly where the convoy is. Its real duty is to be observed. That is, to fly close enough to the convoy that it will be noticed by the lookouts on the ships. The ships will then send out a radio message to the effect that they have been sighted by an Allied observation plane. Then, when we come round and sink them, the Germans will not find it suspicious. At least, not quite so monstrously suspicious that we knew exactly where to go.
Alan stops, consults his compass, turns 90 degrees, and begins pacing westwards.
Well, that strikes me as being a very ad hoc arrangement, Lawrence says. What is the likelihood that Allied observation planes, sent out purportedly at random, will just happen to notice every single Axis convoy?
I've already calculated that probability, and I'll bet you one of my silver bars that Rudy has done it too, Turing says. It is a very small probability.
So I was right, Lawrence says. We have to assume that the jig is up.
Perhaps not just yet, Alan says. It has been touch and go. Last week we sank a convoy in the fog.
In the fog?
It was foggy the whole way. The convoy could not possibly have been observed. The imbeciles sank it anyway. Kesselring became suspicious, as would anyone. So we ginned up a fake message, in a cipher that we know the Nazis have broken, addressed to a fictitious agent in Naples. It congratulated him on betraying that convoy to us. Ever since, the Gestapo have been running rampant on the Naples waterfront, looking for the fellow.
We dodged a bullet there, I'd say.
Indeed. Alan stops abruptly, takes the metal detector from Lawrence and turns it on. He begins to walk slowly across a clearing, sweeping the wire loop back and forth just above the ground. He keeps snagging on branches and getting bent out of shape, necessitating frequent repairs, but remains stubbornly silent the whole time, except when Alan, concerned that it is no longer working, tests it on Lawrence's belt buckle.
The whole business is delicate, Alan muses. Some of our SLUs in North Africa, SLUs, special liaison units, the intelligence officers who receive the ultra information from us, pass it on to field officers, and then make sure it is destroyed. Some of them learned from Ultra that there was to be a German air raid during lunch, so they took their helmets to the mess hall. When the air raid came off as scheduled, everyone wanted to know why those SLUs had known to bring their helmets.
The entire business seems hopeless, Lauren says. How can the Germans not realize?
It seems that way to us, because we know everything, and our channels of communication are free from noise, Alan says. The Germans have fewer and much noisier channels. Unless we continue to do stunningly idiotic things like sinking convoys in the fog, they will never receive any clear and unmistakable indications that we have broken Enigma.
It's funny you should mention Enigma, Lawrence says, since that is an extremely noisy channel from which we manage to extract vast amounts of useful information.
Precisely why I am worried.
Well, I'll do my best to spoof Rudy, Waterhouse says.
You'll do fine. I'm worried about the men who are carrying out the operations.
Colonel Chatton seems pretty dependable, Waterhouse says, though there's probably no point in continuing to reassure Alan. He's just in a fretting mood.
Once every 2 or 3 years, Waterhouse does something that is socially deft, and now's the time. He changes the subject.
And meanwhile, you'll be working it out so that Churchill and Roosevelt can have secret telephone conversations?
In theory. I rather doubt that it's practical. Bell Labs has a system that works by breaking the waveform down into several bands.
And then Alan is off on the subject of telephone companies. He delivers a complete dissertation on the subject of information theory as applied to the human voice, and how that governs the way telephone systems work. It is a good thing that Turing has such a large subject on which to expound, for the woods are large. And it has become increasingly obvious to Lawrence that his friend has no idea where the silver bars are buried. Unburdened by any silver, the two friends ride home in darkness, which comes surprisingly early this far north. They do not talk very much, for Lawrence is still absorbing and digesting everything that Alan has disgorged to him about Detachment 2702 and the convoys and Bell Labs and voice signal redundancy. Every few minutes, a motorcycle whips past them, saddlebags stuffed with encrypted message slips.
Aloft.
Any way that livestock can travel, Bobby Shafto has too. Boxcars, open trucks, forced cross-country marches. Military has now invented the airborne equivalent of these in the form of the Plane of a Thousand Names. DC-3, Skytrain, C-47, Dakota Transport, Goonie Bird. He'll survive. The exposed aluminum ribs of the fuselage are trying to beat him to death, but as long as he stays awake, he can fend them off. The enlisted men are jammed into the other plane. Lieutenants Etheridge and Root are in this one, along with PFC Gerald Hott and Sergeant Bobby Shafto. Lieutenant Etheridge got dibs on all of the soft objects in the plane and arranged them into a nest up forward near the cockpit, and strapped himself down. For a while, he pretended to do paperwork. Then he tried looking out the windows. Now he has fallen asleep and is snoring so loudly that he is, no fooling, drowning out the engines. Enoch Root has wedged himself into the back of the fuselage, where it gets narrow, and is perusing two books at once. It strikes Shafto as typical. He supposes that the books say completely different things and that the chaplain is deriving great pleasure from pitting them against each other, like those guys who have a chessboard on a turntable so they can play against themselves. He supposes that when you live in a shack on a mountain with a bunch of natives who don't speak any of your half-dozen or so languages, you have to learn to have arguments with yourself. There's a row of small square windows on each side of the plane. Shafto looks out to the right and sees mountains covered with snow and gets scared shitless for a moment, thinking maybe they've strayed into the Alps. But off to the left, it still looks like the Mediterranean, and eventually it gives way to Devil's Tower-type outcroppings rising up out of the stony scrubland. And then after that, it is just rocks and sand, or sand without the rocks. Sand puckered here and there for no particular reason by clutches of dunes. Damn it. They are still in Africa. You ought to be able to see lions and giraffes and rhinos. Shafto goes forward to lodge a complaint with the pilot and co-pilot. Maybe he can get a card game together. Maybe the view out the front of the plane is something to write home about. He
is, on all counts, thrown back in stinging defeat. He sees immediately that the project of finding a better view is doomed. There are only three things in the whole universe: sand, sea, and sky. As a Marine, he knows how boring the sea is. The other two are a little better. There is a line of clouds far ahead of them, a front of some description. That's all there is. He gets a general notion of their flight plan before the chart is snatched away and stashed out of his view. They seem to be attempting to fly across Tunisia, which is kind of funny because last time Shafto checked, Tunisia was Nazi territory. The anchor, in fact, of the Axis presence on the African continent. Today's general flight plan seems to be that they'll cut across the straits between Bizerta and Sicily, then head east to Malta. All of Rommel's supplies and reinforcements come across those very straits from Italy and land at Tunis or Bizerta. From there, Rommel can strike out east towards Egypt or west towards Morocco. In the several weeks since the British 8th Army kicked the crap out of him at El Alamein, which is way, way over there in Egypt, he has been retreating westwards back towards Tunis. In the few weeks since the Americans landed in northwest Africa, he's been fighting on a second front to his west. And Rommel has been doing a damn good job of it, as far as Shafto can tell from listening between the stentorian lines of the movie-tone newsreels, so laden with sinister cheer whence the facts before were gleaned. All this means that down below them, vast forces ought to be spread out across the Sahara in readiness for combat. Perhaps there is even a battle going on right now, but Shafto sees nothing. Just the occasional line of yellow dust thrown up by a convoy, a dynamite fuse sputtering across the desert. So he talks to those flyboys. It's not until he notices them giving each other looks that he realizes he's going on at great length. Those assassins must have killed their victims by talking them to death. The card game, he realizes, is completely out of the question. These flyboys don't want to talk. He practically has to dive in and grab the control yoke to get them to say anything. And when they do, they sound funny. And he realizes that these guys are not guys nor fellas. They are blokes, chaps, mates. They are Brits. The only other thing he notices about them before he gives up and slinks back into the cargo hold is that they are fucking armed to the teeth, like they were expecting to have to kill 20 or 30 people on their way from the airplane to the latrine and back. Bobby Shafto has met a few of these paranoid types during his tour, and he doesn't like them very much. That whole mindset reminds him too much of Guadalcanal. He finds a place on the floor next to the body of PFC Gerald Hott and stretches out. A teeny revolver in his waistband makes it impossible for him to lie on his back, so he takes it out and pockets it. This only transfers the center of discomfort to the Marine Raid stiletto holstered invisibly between his shoulder blades. He realizes that he is going to have to curl up on his side, which doesn't work because on one side he has a standard-issue Colt semi-automatic, which he doesn't trust, and on the other his own six-shooter from home, which he does. So he has to find places to stash those, along with the various ammo clips, speed loaders, and maintenance supplies that go with them. The V-44 gung-ho jungle-clearing coconut-splitting and nip-decapitating knife, strapped to the outside of his lower leg, also has to be removed, as does the Derringer that he keeps on the other leg for balance. The only thing that stays with him are the grenades in his front pockets, since he doesn't plan to lie down on his stomach. They make their way around the headland just in time to avoid being washed out to sea by the implacable tide. In front of them is a muddy tidal flat, forming the floor of a box-shaped cove. The walls of the box are formed by the headland they've just gone round, another depressingly similar headland a few hundred yards along the shore, and a cliff rising straight up out of the mudflats. Even if it were not covered with relentlessly hostile tropical jungle, this cliff would seal off access to the interior of Guadalcanal just because of its steepness. The Marines are trapped in this little cove until the tide goes back out, which is more than enough time for the NIP machine gunner to kill them all. They all know the sound of the weapon by now, and so they throw themselves down to the mud instantly. Shafto takes a quick look around. Marines lying on their backs or sides are probably dead. Those on their stomachs are probably alive. Most of them are on their stomachs. The sergeant is conspicuously dead. The gunner aimed for him first. The NIP, or NIPs, have only one gun, but they seem to have all the ammunition in the world. The fruits of the Tokyo Express, which has been coming down the slot with impunity ever since Shafto and the rest of the Marines landed early in August. The gunner takes the mudflats leisurely, zeroing in quickly on any Marine who tries to move. Shafto gets up and runs towards the base of the cliff. Finally, he can see the muzzle flashes from the NIP gun. This tells him which way it's pointed. When the flashes are elongated, it's pointed at someone else, and it's safe to get up and run. When they become foreshortened, it is swinging around to bear on Bobby Shafto. He cuts it too close. There's a very bad pain in his lower right abdomen. His scream is muffled by mud and silt as the weight of his web and helmet drive him face first into the ground. He loses consciousness for a while, perhaps, but it can't have been that long. The firing continues, implying that the Marines are not all dead yet. Shafto raises his head with difficulty, fighting the weight of the helmet, and sees a log between him and the machine gun, a piece of wave-burnished driftwood flung far up the beach by a storm. He can run for it, or not. He decides to run. It's only a few steps. He realizes halfway there that he's going to make it. The adrenaline is finally flowing. He lunges forward mightily and collapses in the shelter of the big log. Half a dozen bullets thunk into the other side of it, and wet, fibrous splinters shower down over him. The log is rotten. Shafto has gotten himself into a bit of a hole and cannot see forward or back without exposing himself. He cannot see his fellow Marines, only hear some of them screaming. He risks a peek at the machine gun nest. It is well concealed by jungle vegetation, but it is evidently built into a cave a good 20 feet above the mudflat. He's not that far from the base of the cliff. He might just reach it with another sprint. But climbing up there is going to be murder. The machine gun probably can't depress far enough to shoot down at him, but they can roll grenades at him until the cows come home, or just pick him off with small arms as he gropes for handholds. It is, in other words, grenade launcher time. Shafto rolls onto his back, extracts a flanged metal tube from his web gear, fits it onto the muzzle of his Ought-3. He tries to clamp it down, but his fingers slip on the bloody wing nut. Oh, who's the pencil neck that decided to use a fucking wing nut in this context? No point griping about it here and now. There is actually blood all over the place, but he is not in pain. He drags his fingers through the sand, gets them all gritty, tightens that wing nut down. Out of its handy pouch comes one Mark II fragmentation grenade, a.k.a. pineapple. And with a bit more groping, he's got the grenade projection adapter M1. He engages the former into the latter, yanks out the safety pin, drops it, then slips the fully prepped and armed grenade projection adapter M1 with its fruity payload over the tube of the grenade launcher. Finally, he opens up one specially marked cartridge case, fumbles through bent and ruptured Lucky Strikes, finds one brass cylinder, a round of ammunition sans payload, crimped at the end but not endowed with an actual bullet. Loads same into the Springfield's firing chamber. He creeps along the log so that he can pop up and fire from an unexpected location and perhaps not get his head chewed off by the machine gun. Finally raises this Rube Goldberg device that his Springfield has become, jams the butt into the sand. In grenade launcher mode, the recoil will break your collarbone. Points it toward the foe, pulls the trigger. Grenade projection adapter M1 is gone with a terrible pow, trailing a damn hardware store of now superfluous parts like a soul discarding its corpse. The pineapple is now soaring heavenward, even its pin and safety lever gone, its chemical fuse aflame so that it even has a, what do you call it, an inner light. Shafto's aim is true, and the grenade is heading where intended. He thinks he's pretty damn smart.
until the grenade bounces back, tumbles down the cliff, and blows up another rotten log. The Nips have anticipated Bobby Shafto's little plan and put up nets or chicken wire or something. He lies on his back in the mud, looking up at the sky, saying the word fuck over and over. The entire log throbs, and something akin to peat moss showers down into his face as the bullets chew up the rotten wood. Bobby Shafto says a prayer to the Almighty and prepares to mount a bonsai charge. Then the maddening sound of the machine gun stops and is replaced by the sound of a man screaming. His voice sounds unfamiliar. Shafto levers himself up on his elbow and realizes that the screaming is coming from the direction of the cave. He looks up into the big sky-blue eyes of Enoch Root. The chaplain has moved from his nook at the back of the plane and is squatting next to one of the little windows, holding on to whatever he can. Bobby Shafto, who has rolled uncomfortably onto his stomach, looks out a window on the opposite side of the plane. He ought to see the sky, but instead he sees a sand dune wheeling past. The sight makes him instantly nauseated. He does not even consider sitting up. Brilliant spots of light are streaking wildly around the inside of the plane like ball lightning, but, and this is far from obvious at first, they are actually projected against the wall of the plane like flashlight beams. He backtraces the beams, taking advantage of a light haze of vaporized hydraulic fluid that has begun to accumulate in the air, and finds that they originate in a series of small circular holes that some asshole has punched through the skin of the plane while he was sleeping. The sun is shining through these holes, always in the same direction, of course, but the plane is going every which way. He realizes that he has actually been lying on the ceiling of the airplane ever since he woke up, which explains why he was on his stomach. When this dawns on him, he vomits. The bright spots all vanish. Very, very reluctantly, Shafto risks a glance out the window and sees only grayness. He thinks he is on the floor now. He is next to the corpse, at any rate, and the corpse was strapped down. He lies there for several minutes, just breathing and thinking. Air whistles through the holes in the fuselage, loud enough to split his head. Someone, some madman, is up on his feet moving about the plane. It is not Root, who is in his little nook dealing with a number of facial lacerations that he picked up during the aerobatics. Shafto looks up and sees that the moving man is one of the British flyboys. The Brit has yanked off his headgear to expose black hair and green eyes. He's in his mid-30s, an old man. He has a knobby utilitarian face in which all the various lumps, knobs, and orifices seem to be there for a reason, a face engineered by the same fellows who design grenade launchers. It is a simple and reliable face, by no means handsome. He is kneeling next to the corpse of Gerald Hodd and is examining it minutely with a flashlight. He is the very picture of concern. His bedside manner is flawless. Finally, he slumps back against the ribbed wall of the fuselage. "Thank God," he says. "He wasn't hit."
"Who wasn't?"
Shafto says. "This chap," the flyboy says, slapping the corpse.
"Aren't you gonna check me?"
"No need to."
"Why not? I'm still alive."
"You weren't hit," the flyboy says confidently. "If you'd been hit, you'd look like Lieutenant Etheridge."
For the first time, Shafto hazards movement. He props himself up on one elbow and finds that the floor of the plane is slick and wet with red fluid. He had noticed a pink mist in the cabin and supposed that it was produced by a hydraulic fluid leak, but the hydraulic system now seems hunky-dory, and the stuff on the floor of the plane is not a petroleum product. It is the same red fluid that figured so prominently in Shafto's nightmare. It is streaming downhill from the direction of Lieutenant Etheridge's cozy nest, and the lieutenant is no longer snoring. Shafto looks at what is left of Etheridge, which bears a striking resemblance to what was lying around that butcher shop earlier today. He does not wish to lose his composure in the presence of the British pilot, and indeed feels strangely calm. Maybe it's the clouds. Cloudy days have always had a calming effect on him.
Holy cow,
he finally says.
That crowd 20mm or something else.
Right, the flyboy says. We've got to get spotted by a convoy, and then we'll proceed with the delivery. Cryptic as it is, this is the most informative statement Bobby's ever heard about the intentions of Detachment 2702. He gets up and follows the pilot back to the cockpit, both of them stepping delicately around several quivering giblets that were presumably flung out of Etheridge.
You mean by an Allied convoy, right?
Shafto asks.
An Allied convoy?
The pilot asks mockingly.
Where the hell are we going to find an Allied convoy? This is Tunisia.
Well, then what do you mean we've got to get spotted by a convoy? You mean we have to spot a convoy, right?
Very sorry, the flyboy says. I'm busy.
When he turns back, he finds Lieutenant Enoch Root kneeling by a relatively large piece of Etheridge, going through Etheridge's attaché case. Shafto cops a look of exaggerated moral outrage and points the finger of blame.
Look, Shafto,
Root shouts.
I'm just following orders, taking over for him.
He pulls out a small bundle, all wrapped in thick yellowish plastic sheeting. He checks it over, then glances up reprovingly one more time at Shafto.
It was a fucking joke,
Shafto says.
Remember when I thought those guys were looting the corpses on the beach?
Root doesn't laugh. Either he's pissed off that Shafto successfully bullshitted him, or he doesn't enjoy corpse-looting humor. Root carries the wrapped bundle back to that other body, the one in the wetsuit. He stuffs the bundle inside the suit. Then he squats by the body and ponders. He ponders for a long time. Shafto kind of gets a kick out of watching Enoch ponder, which is like watching an exotic dancer shake her tits. The light changes again as they descend from the clouds. The sun is setting, shining redly through the Saharan haze. Shafto looks out a window and is startled to see that they are over the sea now. Below them is a convoy of ships, each making a neat white V in the dark water, each lit up on one side by the red sun. The airplane banks and makes a slow loop around the convoy. Shafto hears distant pawking noises. Black flowers bloom and fade in the sky around them. He realizes that the ships are trying to hit them with ak-ak. Then the plane ascends once more into the shelter of the clouds, and it gets nearly dark. He looks at Enoch Root for the first time in a while. Root is sitting back in his little nook, reading by flashlight. A bundle of papers is open on his lap. It is the plastic-wrapped bundle that Root took out of Etheridge's attaché case and shoved into Gerald Hott's wetsuit. Shafto figures that the encounter with Convoy and Ak-Ak finally pushed Root over the edge and that he yanked the bundle right back out again to have a look at it. Root glances up and locks eyes with Shafto. He does not seem nervous or guilty. It is a strikingly calm and cool look. Shafto holds his gaze for a long moment. If there were the slightest trace of guilt or nervousness there, he would turn the chaplain in as a German spy, but there isn't. Enoch Root ain't working for the Germans. He ain't working for the Allies, either. He's working for a higher power. Shafto nods imperceptibly, and Root's gaze softens.
They're all dead, Bobby,
he shouts.
Who? Those islanders, the ones you saw on the beach on Guadalcanal.
So that explains why Root is so touchy about corpse-looting jokes.
Sorry,
Shafto says, moving aft so they don't have to scream at each other.
How'd it happen?
After we got you back to my cabin, I transmitted a message to my handlers in Brisbane,
Root says.
Enciphered it using a special code. Tells them I'd picked up one marine raider who looked like he might actually live, and would someone please come round and collect him?
Shafto nods. He remembers that he'd heard lots of dots and dashes, but he had been out of whack with fevers and morphine and whatever home remedies Root had pulled out of his cigar box.
"Well, they responded," Root went on, "and said we can't go there. But would you please take him to such and such place and rendezvous with some other Marine raiders? Which, as you'll recall, is what we did."
"Yeah,"
Shafto says.
"So far, so good. But when I got back to the cabin after handing you over, the Nipponese had been through. Killed every islander they could find. Burned the cabin. Burned everything. Set booby traps around the place that nearly killed me. I just barely got out of the damn place alive."
Shafto nods, as only a guy who's seen the Nips in action can nod.
"Well, they evacuated me to Brisbane, where I started making a stink about codes. That's the only way they could have found me. Obviously, our codes had been broken. And after I'd made enough of a stink, someone apparently said, 'You're British, you're a priest, you're a medical doctor. You can handle a rifle, you know Morse code, and most importantly of all, you're a fucking pain in the ass. So off you go.' The next thing I know, I'm in that meat locker in Algiers."
Shafto glances away and nods. Root seems to get the message, which is that Shafto doesn't know anything more than he does. Eventually, Enoch Root wraps the bundle up again, just like it was before. But he doesn't put it back in the attaché case. He stuffs it into Gerald Hott's wetsuit. Later they emerge from the clouds again, close to a moonlit port, and dip down very close to the ocean, going so slow that even Shafto, who knows nothing about planes, senses they are about to stall. They open the side door of the Dakota and 1, 2, 3, now, throw the body of PFC Gerald Hott out into the ocean. He makes what would be a big splash in the Oconomowoc town pool, but in the ocean, it doesn't come to much. An hour or so later, they land the same goony bird on an airstrip in the midst of a stunning aerial bombardment. They abandon the SkyTrain at the end of the airstrip, next to the other C-47, and run through darkness, following the lead of the British pilots. Then they go down a stairway and are underground, in a bomb shelter to be precise. They can feel the bombs now, but can't hear them.
"Welcome to Malta,"
someone says. Shafto looks around and sees that he is surrounded by men in British and American uniforms. The Americans are familiar. It's the Marine Raider Squad from Algiers, flown in on that other Dakota. The Brits are unfamiliar, and Shafto pegs them as the SAS men that those fellows in Washington were telling him about. The only thing they all have in common is that each man, somewhere on his uniform, is wearing the number 2702. Non-disclosure. Avi shows up on time, idling his fairly good but not disgustingly ostentatious Nipponese sports car gingerly up the steep road, which has crazed into a loose mosaic of asphalt flagstones. Randy watches from the second-floor deck, staring 50 feet almost straight down through the sunroof. Avi is clad in the trousers of a good tropical white business suit, a tailored white Sea Island cotton shirt, dark ski goggles, and a wide-brimmed canvas hat. The house is a tall, isolated structure rising out of the middle of a Californian grassland that slopes up from the Pacific, a few kilometers away. Chilly air climbs up the slope, rising and falling in slow surges, like surf on a beach. When Avi gets out of his car, the first thing he does is pull on his suit jacket. He hauls two oversized laptop cases out of the tiny luggage compartment in the car's nose, walks into the house without knocking. He has not been to this particular house before, but he has been to others run along similar principles. Finds Randy and Eb waiting in one of its many rooms and hauls about $15,000 worth of portable computer gear out of the bags. He sets them up on a table. Avi hits the start button on two laptops, and as they crawl through the boot process, plugs them into the wall so that the batteries won't drain. A power conduit, with grounded three-prong outlets spaced every 18 inches, has been screwed down remorselessly along every inch of every wall, spanning drywall, holes in the drywall, primeval op-art contact paper, fake wood grain paneling,
faded Grateful Dead posters, and even the odd doorway. One of the laptops is connected to a tiny portable printer, which Abby loads with a few sheets of paper. The other laptop starts up a few lines of text running across the screen, then beeps and stops. Randy ambles over and looks at it curiously. It is displaying a prompt. Philo, which Randy knows is short for Phoenix Loader, a program that allows you to choose which operating system you want to run.
Phoenix,
Avi mumbles, answering Randy's unspoken question. Randy types Phoenix and hits the return key.
How many operating systems you have on this thing?
Windows 95 for games and when I need to let some lamer borrow my computer temporarily, Avi says. Windows NT for office-type stuff, BEOS for hacking and screwing around with media, Phoenix for industrial-strength typesetting.
Which one do you want now?
BEOS. Going to display some JPEGs. I assume there's an overhead projector in this place?
Randy looks over at Eb, the only person in the room who actually lives here.
Eb seems bigger than he is. And maybe it's because of his detonating hair. 2 feet long, blonde with a faint reddish glow, thick and wavy and tending to congeal into ropey strands. No ponytail holder can contain it, so when he bothers to tie it back, he uses a piece of string. Eb is doodling on one of those little computers that uses a stylus so that you can write on the screen. In general, hackers don't use them, but Eb, or rather one of Eb's defunct corporations, wrote the software for this model, and so he has a lot of them lying around. He seems to be absorbed in whatever he's doing, but after Randy has been looking in his direction for 2 seconds, he senses it and looks up. He has pale green eyes and wears a luxuriant red beard, except when he's in one of his shaving phases, which usually coincide with serious romantic involvements. Right now, his beard is about 1/2 inch long, indicating a recent breakup, and implying a willingness to take new risks.
Overhead projector, Randy says.
Eb closes his eyes, which is what he does during memory access, then gets up and walks out of the room. The tiny printer begins to eke paper. The first line of text, centered at the top of the page, is non-disclosure agreement. More lines follow. Randy has seen them, or once like them, so many times that his eyes glaze over and he turns away. The only thing that ever changes is the name of the company. In this case, Epiphyte 2 Corp.
Nice goggles. If you think these are weird, you should see what I'm going to put on when the sun goes down, Avi says.
He rummages in a bag and pulls out a contraption that looks like a pair of glasses without lenses, with a dollhouse-scale light fixture mounted above each eye. A wire runs down to a battery pack with belt loops. He slides a tiny switch on the battery pack, and the lights come on. Expensive-looking blue-white halogen. Randy raises his eyebrows.
It's all jet-lag avoidance, Avi explains. I'm adjusted to Asian time. I'm going back there in 2 days. I don't want my body to get back on left coast time while I'm here.
So the hat and goggles simulate night. This thing simulates daylight.
See, your body takes its cues from the light, adjusts its clock accordingly. Speaking of which, would you mind closing the blinds?
The room has west-facing windows, affording a view down the grassy slope to Half Moon Bay. It is late afternoon, and the sun is pouring through. Randy savors the view for a moment, then drops the blinds.